Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, today our guest is Mike Cantu. Mike is one of the most successful real estate investors in California, as well as an up-and-coming successful trainer. Mike, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
How do you feel about high use of leverage in 2009?
Proper leverage, if you're buying at the right price in this market, is a wonderful thing.
I agree with that. I was curious to know what your answer is, but this is a very unique situation where even high leverage could get you cash flow that's very safe.
Yes. Now, the challenge here is finding that leverage, finding the long-term leverage. There's a bunch of short-term leverage out there, but long-term is slim pickings right now.
Yeah, it is. I get tons of emails and calls about, okay, what's the secret? And there isn't one yet.
Right.
We're getting, I think, blamed for the whole mess, the speculator, so therefore we're getting locked out of all but four loans, or maybe 10, I guess, depending if you buy Fannie Mae's repos now.
Right, but still, that's full qualifying, full everything, and I've never been much of a borrower. It wasn't until stated income to where I actually was able to do about one loan a year through there, and I did do it on properties that I kept. I was able to get a few decent fixed-rate long-term loans, but I've never been much of a borrower, so it is a challenge right now.
I think that'll solve itself because I don't think they'll be able to sell enough of these properties quick enough to the owner-occupants, and I think ultimately they'll figure out that maybe we'll play a role, and that would be a good day if they do that.
Right. I've always said that real estate's a moving target, that every year the game changes, the playing field changes, and this year is certainly no exception to that rule.
No. If you could order up your next rental to be the perfect long-term keeper, give me a description of what that house would be, type of location, age, that type of thing.
It's going to be, preferably if I have my way, this is my ideal house, a three-bedroom, two-bath, between 1,200 and 1,600 square feet. Somewhere right in the middle would work nicely.
In the middle? Oh, the square footage?
Yeah, okay. Somewhere around 1,400 is about my favorite size rental house. I like an A neighborhood. I prefer post-1950 construction. And the reason I say that is some of the best neighborhoods that I deal in were built out in the late 40s and early 50s. Like the city of Claremont hasn't had a lot of new building in the last decade or so. But those are some great neighborhoods there. So I'm not opposed to going backwards 50 years as far as the construction goes. But not on a busy street. If I had my way, they'd all be in cul-de-sacs. I like a good school district. I like a two-car garage. And I like a good floor plan. Single-story house, good solid construction. I don't care for the 212-pitch roof, the gravel roof stuff, the vaulted ceilings, cheap construction. I like a well-built house, middle of the block, in a good neighborhood.
And you probably have all those neighborhoods sort of scouted out at this point in your area. I mean, did you literally drive around and say, okay, this is my target?
Yes. I being a buy-sell person, I do get around my marketplace, and early on, many years ago, back in the 80s, I identified neighborhoods that I would really like to have houses in, and I've gone out of my way to target those neighborhoods.
If something came up and it was a little out of your parameter as far as a buy-sell purchase, but it was the kind that you want long-term, is that something you'll pay a premium for?
I didn't understand that question, Bruce.
No, if you're going to, let's say if you're in a buy-sell mode, you'd have a price in mind. If you're going to keep that same home as a rental, would you pay more for that property?
Oh, absolutely I would. If I could make any financial sense out of it, I'm going to look at it from the rental standpoint. I love a buy-sell check, but what really gets me excited in this business is picking up a good house that I know is going to be part of my portfolio probably for as long as I'm in business, if not the rest of my life, and that just excites me to no end. So, yes, I will pay a premium, and I have done so in the past. And the best location properties, the little bit of a premium I've had to pay looking back was a pittance compared to what they've done financially for me.
The neighborhoods that you pick, the 1950 neighborhoods, why is that more desirable for the tenant? It's the school district, if they don't have kids? Is it just the fact that it's close to shopping and that type of thing?
Not necessarily. It's more the environment. I like a pride of ownership neighborhood, and anything built in the 50s most likely going to have a lot of trees. I love a tree-lined street that just has a pleasant environment. It feels like a homey neighborhood, not like suburbia.
Okay.
I think it has a lot to do with just the overall charm and feel of it, and most of the houses that I manage these days, as I pull up in front of them, I think I could live in this house. That'd be no problem. Nice neighborhood. I wouldn't be afraid to walk my dog late at night and not carry a weapon with me and would be very comfortable there. In fact, that's one of my criteria. When I decide to keep something, I always end up back there late at night and think, is this someplace that I'm comfortable? If I had to get out of my car and walk around the block, would I do it? And if the answer is no, then most likely that's going to be a push-forward property and not the long-term keeper. I'm going to use it as a tool to pay down something else.
Okay. What is it that you look for in a renter? So, once again, if you had somebody filling out a rental application and you look at it and you go, okay, this is the prototype person. This is my preference.
Well, first of all, I want the right number of people. I want somebody that is going to stay for a minimum of 2 years. I'm not in the hotel business. And that's right number of people. How long are you going to stay? I want to know about their pets. I prefer not to have pets. Not that I dislike pets, but I've yet to meet a dog that's ever improved a rental property of mine. I want to know when they're ready to move. And the big question is, do they have all of the money together?
Okay.
And that once they get past all that, I'm actually sit down for an hour during the rental agreement signing process, and I tell them what their job description is. I explain to them that it's like hiring someone, that I'm hiring an employee, and go over the job description. I explain to them that their job description is to take care of the house first and foremost, to pay the rent on time, to maintain the grounds, to stay at least 2 years, get along with the neighbors, and most important, to be a good steward of the asset.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm looking for in a tenant.
Is that an unusual speech for them to hear if they're a renter?
Yes. Most people aren't used to the 1 hour, and I tell them we've got to clear it out. If all goes as planned, we might get done in 45 minutes, but I usually take up the better part of that hour. See, I want to share expectations. I don't want to sign somebody up and just have optimistic expectations when they're on a completely different page. And I share the expectations, I explain the rules, and I asked a lot of very pointed questions so that we have no ambiguous interpretation of what was said.
Is this somehow recorded?
I don't think I've ever recorded one of those.
Okay, just curious.
But no, I asked some very stiff questions. One of them that I always ask is, what excuse would you accept from your employer for not getting paid this month? And that's usually a very short list, and I say my list is going to be very similar to that list.
Mm-hmm. Are people sometimes offended by the directness of the questions?
I've had a few people over the years offended by it, but at the same time I'm thinking, I'm glad we got that out of the way because this most likely wouldn't have worked out.
Right. And in other words, also, you're trying, it's not just someone that looks good on paper, that they got to sort of be a good match for what you expect.
Right, and at the end of that hour period, and if we do get to the rental agreement signing and exchanging of the money and everything, tell them that now we're officially on the same page, and my goal is for you to forget what I look like. That you're not going to see me. I'm not the guy that's going to be stopping by every 30 days. And I'll do a semi-annual drive-by, and if the place is looking good and the rent's been on time, that's about as much as you're going to see of me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't uphold your end of the deal, you're going to get sick of my face.
And let's say the rent's due on the first. How long would it take me to hear from you?
As a new tenant, during the first year, you're going to hear from me by the third or the fourth if I haven't received the rent. I explain to new tenants that, see, early on I was a nice guy, and it's just human nature to push, and see what you can get away with. So I figured I'd reverse that role and be kind of the tough guy going out of the gate and then soften up as the relationship expanded and grew. But going out of the gate, I'll be serving a three-day notice on the third or the fourth. Now, I do have a $100 late fee that doesn't become effective till end of business on the fifth day, but I tell the people, your rent's due on the first, it's late on the second. You're going to pay a late fee on the fifth, and as they wait there in the middle, and they think, well, you know, what's the difference between the second, third, and fourth? that we've still got the rent before the late fee. I say, no, the rent's due on the first. That's a conversation we had, and that's going to affect future rent raises and how I deal with you and everything else in the future. If you're consistently late after the first but before the fifth, in my books, you're late every single month.
Mm-hmm.
And by the fifth, you're going to pay for it. Now, I do have exceptions to that, and I explain to people that I was a tenant for a long time, and I don't like surprises. So as long as you call me up ahead of time before the first, tell me you're going to be late, but at that when during that call, I want a specific date as to when I am going to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a courtesy that I'll extend once, twice, maybe three times, but it's certainly not going to be a habit. You're not going to call me every month and tell me the rent's going to be there on the 15th. You're going to start paying late fees.
How often do you hear from a tenant in a year's time? I was going to say a month's time, but I guess that would probably be zero. So
I'm going to say in a year's time, I probably hear on average maybe twice. And there's tenants I have not heard from in 5, 6, 7 years. I tell the story about a few years ago. A guy walked into my office and knocked on the door, and I said, "Can I help you?" And he said he was here to pay the rent. And I looked at him, and my eyes worked pretty good. And I said, "For what?" I didn't know who that guy was, and he gave me a property address. And I realized I had not seen the man in 8 years, that when I had originally rented to him, he had a full head of hair and was physically fit. And he didn't even resemble the guy that I rented to.
That's pretty funny.
So in that case, that was the first interaction I'd had with the guy since he'd never called for repairs or anything. But that's, speaking of that, I prefer to rent to blue-collar people. They are very handy and take care of a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So is that part of the deal, that they don't send you bills for the miscellaneous stuff, or they
do? No. I explained to somebody that I'm happy to buy a receipt back for that minor stuff, because I would just assume they spent the money and solved the problem rather than let it fester into a bigger problem to where I'm going to write a much bigger check.
Okay.
And most of those blue-collar people that do fix the stuff, they just send me the receipt, and I'll cut them a check and send them back a check for the materials.
Gotcha.
Okay. I'm always happy to pay for an improvement, too, like that.
In the interview process, what are some of the questions you are tempted to ask but would be illegal to ask?
Well, I don't have many of those off the top of my head, Bruce, but the first question I ask, I like to start my interview out with, "Do you pay your bills on time?"
Mm-hmm.
And I've never got a no. And I say, "Good, we don't have a grace period. Rent's due on the first, it's late on the second. Glad we got that out of the way."
You have a good sense of humor. Do you use it, or is that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was going to say, Bruce, in my world, property management, I think of it as a science and an art, because you've got personalities and different techniques involved. So everybody's program is going to be a little bit different. So you got to play the hand you're dealt. And I know that I am who I am, so I try and play that and integrate it in there and make people comfortable. But, yeah, humor is definitely part of that.
Okay. What are some of the things that you really can't ask when you're talking to a tenant? Because there's, I'm sure lots of people would break rules within the first minute that they had no idea. No, I can't ask that. You got to be kidding.
Oh, yeah. And the first set of guidelines that you're bound by is the Fair Housing Guidelines. You have to be in compliance with the Fair Housing Guidelines. And that's the big one there. Source of income. People think that they can discriminate, but as far as source of income, but I know that's part of the Fair Housing Guidelines, and that you can't discriminate over someone's income, strippers and attorneys included, that if you have moral issues with both of those people, you're stuck, that that's not something you can discriminate over.
Well, then you can't even ask the question, I guess.
No, and that's one of the things that I absolutely want to know, and of my five questions I ask people over the phone, Of the five questions I'm asking over the phone, there's really a sixth one, and that's verifiable income. So I don't get that information until I get the rental application back.
What's something a renter can say that gives you immediate concern?
What was that, Bruce?
What's something that a renter can say that gives you immediate concern?
Dogs. When I'm interviewing people, my biggest concern is the pet issue. I am limited by my insurance. There is a list of dogs that you can't have, and there's also weight category. And one of my first concerns is people sneaking in pets. I recently had a pit bull issue, and I had to give them the 3-day notice to comply with that. And, yeah, pets are a big concern of mine.
Okay. Now, are you allowed to minimize or eliminate those if you chose?
Yes, if it's part of your rental agreement and you state that it's not in there, that they're not allowed to have pets, absolutely. When I found out about the pit bulls, I sent them the letter that stated that they were in violation of their rental agreement, and we did have an addendum for that that specifically stated no pets, and I sent the letter saying in 72 hours, if the dogs are still there, I'll notify proper authorities to have them removed and treat them as strays, which I know was a little bit harsh, but the dogs left. And that was more of a concern from my standpoint from the insurance liability.
Okay. What's the biggest surprise a renter has ever surprised you with?
The biggest surprise, pleasant or unpleasant, Bruce?
One of each would be perfect.
I've had many pleasant surprises over improvements that people have done over the years.
And they just did it and didn't tell you and didn't ask you to pay?
Exactly. I've had some wonderful upgrades done. I've had some nice paint jobs, sprinkler systems, landscape jobs, trees planted. I've had lots of stuff like that. From the disappointing standpoint, a couple of them come to mind. They made a three-bedroom into a two-bedroom, and they took out a bearing wall and kind of propped things up, which I didn't appreciate.
Wow.
I've had some paint jobs that took two and three coats of paint to just get back to white so I could put the real coat of paint on.
Okay.
I've witnessed carpet, good carpet, within 6 months turning into something that needed to be pulled out, taken out back, and shot.
A motorcycle rehab or something?
I'm amazed at how people live. I do my darndest. I like to stop by and make a surprise visit where they're living. My attitude on that is if they're wrecking the place they're in, mine's next. So I try and prevent that stuff up front, but still, I've had people change, too. I've had good people go through divorce, start drinking, and just turn into complete pigs and destroy a house.
What are your feelings about using Section 8?
Now, I have mixed feelings on Section 8. I know there's a lot of compliance there. The biggest problem I have with Section 8, I know it's a good program. My mentor, Mick, did very well with it. The thought of your checks coming monthly from the government, that's nice as long as they get there.
As long as it's not an IOU.
Exactly. And I don't want to go too far on a limb, but I like being independent. I don't want to rely on our government for my income if I don't have to. But I've seen good and bad from the Section 8 program. The biggest problem I have, Bruce, is I've inherited quite a few Section 8 tenants over the years in my property purchases that came with other people's tenants. And the biggest problem is when we have the inspection, that several times the inspector showed up and they've done their inspection. They've given me a list of things. And I've always been one with the attitude that if it's a repair and it's just worn out, needs to be replaced, that's my job. But if it's broken, I don't think I should pay for it. And I explained to Section 8 inspector and the tenant that it's my experience is houses don't break themselves. People break houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll point it out and ask them when they're going to fix it. And Section 8's always told me, we don't do that. That's your job. And I ask the tenant, when are you going to take care of that? And they say, I'm not going to fix it. And I say, well, I didn't break it. And it's the house you're living in. Until somebody fixes it, we're not going any farther. And 100% of the time, we've terminated at that point. The one that always amazed me was the two screens. They were two $25 screens. They were less than a year old. They were mangled. Lady, when I asked what happened, she said, none of your business. I said, you're going to fix them? She said, absolutely not. I said, you're going to be moving? And she said, so be it. So that's the biggest problem I have, because my tenants, if something's broken, we're going to have a discussion about it, and I'm going to explain to them that I've been around a while, and I know the difference between wore out and broke, and they're going to end up paying for it. The few people that I butted heads with, I thought, okay, they didn't want to pay for it once. I'm just going to raise the rent by that amount, and they can pay for it every month from here on out.
Okay. By the way, we've had price declines, unbelievable price declines. What's happened to rents in the areas that you're most familiar with?
Now, I'm in the west end of my buy-sell market. The west end of it is where I keep stuff, and I know that a lot of people that were renters moved out of this area up to the high desert or went east in search of affordable housing, and with all the foreclosures, a lot of those people that lost their houses have migrated back to the west end of my marketplace where they originally came from. I don't see somebody moving up to the high desert to own a house, losing the house, and then becoming a tenant up there.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason they were up there was for affordability. So my rental market has been very strong. I went through a handful of vacancies last year, and every one of those, once they were rent-ready, were rented up within 30 days. I don't know what the high desert's doing, and I don't know what the eastern end of my marketplace is. I know there's a lot of stuff available, but I'm not familiar with the absorption rate. I haven't had to reduce rents or anything. We're in the west end of my market's very strong.
That's really a nice thing when prices go down by half and your rents stay the same. That's a nice.
I actually did a round of rent raises already this year, and I haven't heard back from anybody that they're moving.
That's a good sign.
Yes.
What are some of the biggest mistakes you see new landlords make?
Buying the wrong house.
Okay.
Overestimating what they can get in rent. The market dictates the rent. You can be way under market and no problem finding a tenant, but you can't be way over. It's just like selling a house, that you can give it away cheap, sell it right away, but if you're asking twice what it's worth, it's going to sit there forever. And the second mistake I see is once they get the house, whether it's the right house or the wrong house, they don't do their homework checking out tenants. And then the fatal mistake is accepting a personal check for security deposit and the first month's rent. Those are the recurring theme that I see people doing.
Okay. Now, do you accept checks after they're there?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I tell people it's cash, cashier's check, or money order to move in. I will accept a personal check till the second one bounces. At that point, we're done. It's going to be money orders from then on out.
And that's part of your 45 to 60 minute discussion in the beginning?
Yes. Sorry. Oh, yes. We go over complete payment and what happens and bounce check fees, everything else.
Okay. Evictions, do you delegate them to a company or do that yourself?
I started off doing them myself. My mentor, Mick, anything that I hadn't done in this business made me do it one time at least. He would coach me, oversee me. I remember I told him I was terrified of electricity. The first house we bought was on fuses, and he stood 3 to 5 feet away all day long instructing me while I did a service panel change out. The first tenant we didn't have or that we had that didn't pay, he said, now you got to go through your eviction. I actually went through several of them. And then I did an eviction on my own. It was about the fourth or fifth one, and I missed not one but two boxes checked, and I went through the system, and the whole thing got kicked back. And at that point, I started using the eviction company. I've had good and bad results with them. Mick still does his own evictions to this day. He's the most efficient evictor I've ever seen, and I've even pleaded with him, would you do my evictions for me? He just does his own, and I'm at a point now after a few less than pleased with the services I got, I may start doing my own again. But I don't do that many evictions, one every few years at most.
Okay, so it's not a big deal.
No.
Property managers, you don't use one?
No.
And would you recommend that plan for other people?
Before you pay somebody to manage your properties for you, I strongly suggest you go out there and learn what it is you're going to pay somebody to do. I had a condo in Palm Springs back in the, I acquired that in the 80s. I had it for quite some time. I used to go out there on the weekends occasionally and golf, and then I'd rent it out periodically like a vacation rental. Then I went through the management company for that condo complex, and eventually I was leasing it or renting it out full-time, month-to-month, long-term. But that was the only management company I had any experience with, but I dealt with them for several years, and I ended up coming up with two pages of questions if I ever have another property management company in my life. I did come up with a whole bunch of criteria on what I'm interested in for a management company.
Okay.
But I think you should learn the business first so you know if they're doing a good job or not.
We got one more minute left. Somebody that's just saying, okay, I'm going to start my rental portfolio, what would be maybe as many as you think they could handle if starting from scratch? How many new rentals can you absorb?
If you're buying a repo property that needs work, to go from the purchase, close it, to go through the rehab and the rent-up period, that's going to take you, I'm going to say you want to allocate probably 3 months for that, to rehab it and then go through the rent-up period. And for a new person, I wouldn't recommend more than four a year, one a quarter. You might be able to sneak a fifth one in there, but you want to learn as you go. Get the house, fix it up, get it rented, then repeat. I disagree with going out and buying a whole bunch of them, have them sitting around, and one at a time getting around to getting them ready. I think you do them one at a time, get them up and running, and then do one more after that.
Okay. Mike, we're out of time. Once again, Mike's teaching February 21st. All he knows about the rental market. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Okay, Bruce. My pleasure.
All right.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.